Welcome to Fundraising Stories with Female Founders. I'm Julia Elliott Brown, the founder and CEO of Enter the Arena. I'm a serial entrepreneur and an expert in raising investment and business growth. Our mission at Enter the Arena is to empower female founders to fly through pre-raise and investment and onto the exponential growth of their business with investment expertise and business coaching. Here we share the stories of inspirational female founders who've raised investment to inspire you to do the same. You'll hear their honest accounts of what it was really like to secure funding, the highs, the lows, and the challenges they experienced on the journey. And along the way, we'll discuss top tips for how you can be successful too. Today I'm speaking with the award-winning entrepreneur Merrily Carr, the CEO and founder of Under the Doormat. Now, Under the Doormat is a peer-to-peer house rental service with a luxury difference. They take the kind of Airbnb concept, but make your experience much more like staying in a hotel, with all the little touches you'd expect, like beautifully folded towels, chocolates on the pillow, you get a concierge service, personal check-ins and welcome, and you feel really looked after for your stay. And for homeowners, guests are fully vetted and the service is totally managed for you. Now, Merrily started Under the Doormat in 2014 after 13 years working in a big corporate. And in growing the business, she's won several awards, including Entrepreneur of the Year in 2018 and Businesswoman of the Year in 2019. And Merrily's also very influential in her industry, chairing the UK Short-Term Accommodation Association, as well as working with various government bodies to help professionalise and grow the sector. Now, since launch 6 years ago, Under the Doormat has taken around 4.7 million in gross bookings, with guests from over 80 countries, over 59,000 guest nights hosted across 350 homes. So it's pretty impressive growth. And in the past couple of years, Merrily has raised a total of around 2.5 million in equity finance to grow Under the Doormat through five separate crowdfunding rounds, which we're going to talk all about today, including an advanced subscription round she's just closed, which has been match funded by the new Government Future Fund, which has been launched to help support venture investment during the pandemic. So I can't wait to hear more about Merrily's journey and all the lessons she's raised whilst raising investment. Welcome to the show, Merrily.
Really, really happy to be here. Thank you very much.
So before we start talking about fundraising, I want to know how on earth you came to start Under the Doormat after having worked for 13 years at Shell. It's kind of a leap.
Absolutely. I mean, I think it probably comes down to, you know, I've always been a bit of an entrepreneur at heart. You know, even in the corporate world, I was always the person that, you know, when they had a major change project or something they wanted to fundamentally do differently in the business, that's where they would put me. And so I think disruption and doing things differently and growing and changing things has kind of been part of my DNA always. And I always knew that I wanted to be an entrepreneur one day, but like many people, you want to be passionate enough about the idea. I mean, it's not just something you do for a year or two. You've really got to be committed to it. And I also feel like actually making that leap and making that change later in my career was probably the best thing I could do, because there's so much experience I gained during my time in the corporate world that means I can now do much bigger deals and grow as the business grows. So in a funny sort of way, it was actually probably for me the first few years of being an entrepreneur that were the hardest. And the more the company grows, the more I grow back into the stuff that I used to do. And so I sometimes call it like reverse entrepreneur, because, you know, most people, when they're an entrepreneur, they get to a certain size and then they're a bit out of their comfort zone. And that's kind of the opposite for me. So, you know, look, I think every journey is different, but certainly from my point of view, it was absolutely the right decision. I've never regretted it for one second. But I think, you know, it is very different from having all those structures around you. So you have to know that that's what you really want and be willing to get your hands dirty, do everything, and also have that really steep learning curve all over again.
Yeah, it's the hustle period, isn't it, at the beginning, when there's nobody to fix your computer or empty the bin, you're kind of doing it all, aren't you? So, but I mean, how did you come up with the idea in the first place for Under the Doormat?
I mean, look, it comes from personal experience. Now, obviously, when I was in Shell, I'd actually done property management, but in a very different world. So I managed the maintenance of 12,000 petrol sites across 43 countries. But obviously, having had that experience, of course, you do understand a lot about properties and how they're managed and all the processes and systems and everything that goes behind that. And at the time, Airbnb was just starting to emerge and this kind of peer-to-peer concept was there. And, you know, amongst my friends, I was always the one to organize the ski chalet or, you know, when we went to travel for a triathlon to book a home for us to stay in where we were going. And I really preferred, you know, when you're traveling with a group of friends, for example, staying in a home. But I found it really difficult to find the quality of homes that we wanted and, you know, easily bookable and well managed. And, you know, we traveled for a triathlon to Lausanne and we're staying in a home there. And we arrived and, you know, the owners were very apologetic, but it hadn't been cleaned. Their cleaner hadn't shown up. And also they forgot to mention anywhere that we'd also be cat sitting for them. And that just really wasn't what you'd expect. And so what I realized is there were a lot of people like me who travel for work, whose homes sit empty for long periods of time. But often the people who have really nice homes are not the people to manage them. And equally, guests want to know that it's going to be a hotel experience. They don't want to be worried about who's going to meet them. Is it going to be clean? What are the sheets like? You know, they want to know that they can arrive and relax and expect a certain quality. And so I just realized that while peer-to-peer has a place, and I think what Airbnb has done in creating a market is absolutely fantastic, there had to be a more professional segment of the market that would emerge as this market grows and more people stay in homes versus hotels. And so that was really the opportunity I saw, was the professionalization of the market, working at that sort of premium and luxury end, and having that consistent curated experience for both homeowners and guests.
Fantastic. That's great. Thank you. So at the beginning, I mean, you know, you're building something which actually needs two sides to the market. You can't really launch it unless you've got enough volume. I imagine there was quite a lot of work to do at the start to get this, to get yourself a platform and market what you were doing. How did you fund things right at the start?
So at the beginning, you know, I funded a little bit of it myself. So I think originally I put in something like £20,000 and, you know, started by giving a loan to the business. And that was actually some advice I got from an FD who I knew, who actually said, you know, at the beginning, even if you're putting it in, you probably should do that as a loan so that you can then find tax efficient ways to take it out later. So that's obviously a useful tip for people to know. And then very quickly, I had a board of advisors that I put together as I launched the business. And I look back and that was probably one of the best decisions I made because I had experts, technology, finance, marketing, et cetera. And they were all helping to advise me on what I needed to do to get this business off the ground because they were really passionate about the idea and wanted to be involved. And so what I did was actually offer the opportunity for them to buy shares in the business very early on. And so that was my first friends and family round. And I raised about 100,000 at that point in time. Now we very much took a bootstrapping approach to things. And, you know, if I look back at it, you know, you can always raise larger sums earlier. Of course, if you do, there's a cost to that because you're doing that at a very low valuation. So we took the approach of raising very little early on, and it was probably only 3 years into the business before we actually did our first seed round. And that was probably our only really proper crowdfunding round that we've done. And at that stage, we just thought, look, we're going to need more resource. We're going to need to actually scale this if we want to achieve our goals. And we're going to need more investment to do that. And so I think in that round, we hit 220% of our target. We raised, I think, 387,000. So it was our first proper financing. And, you know, that was, you know, the first time you do that, a really scary process because it's very different to just raising from people who already know the business when you're going out to lots of stakeholders and other people and also strangers who have the opportunity to get involved and invest in it.
I mean, I think such excellent advice about getting a board of directors on early. And so many entrepreneurs leave that until they've been operating for 2-3 years. But if you get a really strong board of advisors right from the start, it massively accelerates your growth. And as you've said, if they come in as investors too, that's just phenomenal. So that first round of crowdfunding, I mean, why go for crowdfunding at that point? How far had you got with the business? Did you already have a tribe of followers, of customers that you could bring in on that crowdfunding round?
Yeah, so I think from memory, when we launched, we had about 58% of our target already hit. And we did that actually very simply. So we, you know, we had our newsletter subscriber base, you know, people that we knew that were interested in the business, that were following us, all those kinds of things. And so what we did was, before we ever launched, we went out and we said, hey, you know, if anyone's interested in investing in the business, there's this concept called crowdfunding, because back then it was still relatively new. So you were almost educating people on the fact that they could do it first, and then educating them on your specific opportunity to invest in your business. And so that's what we did. And we got pledges in. So there's a little form they could fill out on the website saying, yeah, I'm interested. Here's how much I'd be interested in investing. And so that by the time we actually kind of went live with Cedars into what they call their private campaign, which lasts a week or so, then we already had those pledges. So we knew exactly where we could get to. And then we just, you know, materialized those pledges and then went live to the public. Now, we actually ended up with some pretty tricky timing, actually, because we were private just at the moment of the Brexit referendum, which, of course, is, you know, one of these macroeconomic events and everything. And the result was, of course, unexpected. And we had our whole communications plan and everything that we'd built out for the crowdfunding round. And we'd sort of said, well, look, I mean, this whole Brexit referendum thing is a bit of a risk, but, you know, that's okay, because everybody's going to vote for it to, for us to stay in, nothing will change and it will be fine. And then when, of course, something different happened, then we had to quickly reevaluate. So we stayed private a bit longer, let, you know, things settle a bit, and then delayed our launch to the public by about a week to make sure that we weren't launching at a moment where, you know, everybody's minds were on other things.
I mean, as much as you can plan and strategize about your fundraising campaign, things never quite work out how you think, do they? You have to stay nimble and, as you say, be able to react when things happen that are out of your control. So interesting. I mean, what I find quite interesting, Merrily, is that you have with your fundraising, you've gone for a number of, I suppose, reasonably modest raises, as opposed to the more traditional path of seed investment and then on to a Series A. Was that a strategic decision, or again, was that just you reacting to what was going on in the market as you grew?
So it's much more of a strategic decision. I think you've got several choices of the route you want to take in terms of raising funds. I was always clear that I didn't want to get diluted too early. And I was also clear that I didn't want to be going down that VC track. So we see, you know, I mean, VCs want pure tech businesses. They want, you know, 1 out of 10 to be the next unicorn. And they're not very interested in solid businesses that might reach a valuation of 100 million, which I would argue is pretty interesting still. And so it's understanding which capital you want to go for. We've always gone for strategic capital. So most of our investors are people who come from, for example, the hospitality industry, so traditional hotels. We've got, for example, in one of our rounds, our board member, Derek Gamage, who's chairman of CBRE Hotels. And we've got Rory Hardick, who comes from the property world. He's a founding partner of M3 Capital, which is private equity in the property world. So, I mean, we very much see ourselves at the intersection of property and hospitality with technology at the core. But what you find when you talk to VCs is they want the next unicorn and they want the next tech SaaS business. And I think a lot of entrepreneurs go down that route and end up on the ABC kind of tread wheel. And there is no getting off that. And I think it's really understanding, do you see your business as a successful business that in 5-10 years time might be sold to a strategic investor, or indeed might become just a profitable business that is really successful long term? or do you want to go down that VC track? And I think that's a strategic decision every entrepreneur should take very early on in your journey, because being purposeful about that is really important. Because if you end up taking VC investment, you will automatically be going down a track where very often you as an entrepreneur will lose control of the direction of your business. And some people are happy with that because the VC track is exactly what they want to achieve. But that certainly wasn't our strategy. And you know, that's why we've taken the approach we have. And equally, one of the things that you can do is try and just raise as much money as possible. But of course, if you raise less money more frequently, each time you raise, assuming everything goes to plan, your valuation is increasing. So the dilution of your early investors is lower if you do that in a stepped approach, which is the way that we've taken and approached it. And you know, arguably, could we have raised more earlier on and then avoided the need to raise as often? Well, absolutely, but we would have given away more equity to do that.
Yeah, I mean, it's a long-term game you're playing when you're fundraising. And I think it's so important for people to think through that strategically rather than just making a gut decision on the next round. So it's clever what you've done. And I have to agree with you. I prefer smaller, more frequent raises. As long as you raise enough, you know, if you're not raising enough then and you're constantly fundraising, that can be a little bit tedious. But the VC path can often, it's either kind of scale fast or you're going to get dropped like a hot stone. And then there's no other way out. It's something that I experienced myself. I took VC funding on, and that's exactly what happened to my business. So I've learned that lesson myself.
Yeah, I think there's one of the founders of a really successful company that actually sold out and had gone down the VC track. She's now gone back and been an entrepreneur a second time. And she said her number one goal is to get that business to profitability as quickly as she possibly can. Because once you're a profitable business, you're in the driving seat. And I think that's, you know, although we've not fully taken that approach, it's kind of this balance between growth versus profitability. You know, we know that we're within reach of profitability if we needed to be. And we still see scaling and growth as important, which is why we're taking investment rather than just funding ourselves with the profits. But I think that's important. And, you know, very often it becomes a case of just going for growth with no view of how you're going to turn the business profitable. And that puts you as an entrepreneur at huge risk that you're at the mercy of the VCs and the investors.
Yeah, absolutely. It's all about, you know, you've got to think, why are you building the business? You're building the business for you, to create value for you, to create value for your customers. And you have to build the business that way. So with the crowdfunding, Merrily, I mean, obviously, for a brand like yours, which is a very consumer-facing brand, there's an advantage to going through crowdfunding anyway, because you're building a network of brand ambassadors as you go. But how did you find the structure of those rounds? Were they mostly made up of bigger lead investors? How much did a bigger crowd come into play?
So, I mean, if we look overall in terms of the investors that we've had come on board throughout the rounds, I think we've got just over 500 investors through the nominee structures or the crowdfunding. But the vast majority of those are very small investors. Whereas our private investors, you know, the average ticket, you know, when we initially did rounds was around £10,000. And now, you know, in our most recent round, you know, the smallest new investor that came in invested £20,000. So, you know, as you get further along, then, you know, that amount tends to creep up. Whereas, I mean, I don't know, the average for our crowdfunding investors is probably like £500 or something. So it's very, very small. So I think it's understanding what your objective is for crowdfunding, because actually the majority of our investment isn't from the crowd. The majority of our investment has come privately, and we've just done little top-ups with crowdfunding more for the PR value and that ambassador value than for actually having that be the source of our funding. And I think that's really important, because I think it's really difficult to raise a round through the crowd. In fact, I even think, you know, the companies that do crowdfunding nowadays even advise you against that. Because it's at the end going to be your investors that are your core investors. And you might get a few investors that come in through the crowd that kind of top it up. And so I think that's very different than sometimes the impression people have, like, oh, I'll just put my business up and all of a sudden all these strangers are going to start putting money in. You know, I mean, we've always had more than 50% already committed when we've gone live on the crowd. And I would argue more than 80% of any round has come through our own private channels, not through crowdfunding.
Yeah, I mean, I've noticed as the years have gone by, you know, I did my first crowdfunding round a couple of years before you did yours, I think. And the advice then was, you know, maybe 25% committed in advance. Now the advice is more like you kind of want at least 80% committed before you go live. It's sort of become more and more important as a part of the structure. But it's interesting, you mentioned the kind of the value of having those smaller investors, the PR value, the value of brand ambassadors. As someone who's very experienced in crowdfunding, have you been able to measure that value in any way? Can you see the real value of having lots and lots of smaller investors who've come in with average of £500 investment?
Yeah, I mean, look, obviously when you go through the crowdfunding platforms, it's not as complicated as having all these investors. I mean, you know, they're on our newsletter. I write to my investors once a quarter, but I would do those things anyway. So it's not that having that group of investors creates a lot of extra work, because it's a nominee structure anyway. So I think it's more a case of, you know, what we see, we've had new homeowners come on board as a result of it. We've had, you know, of course, people who are out there recommending you to other people. It's very difficult to measure that, because often people don't necessarily tell you that's exactly why they booked your accommodation or why they became a homeowner. But sometimes it's obvious, like, you know, they're already in our database as an investor, and then they call up as a potential homeowner and you're like, oh, okay, great, you're an investor. So I think that sort of thing, we definitely have seen a value in it. It's very difficult to quantify. And I would argue that, you know, again, if you're doing it solely for a quantifiable value to say, like, I'm going to do this instead of investing X amount in this other marketing channel, maybe not. But if you see it as a bit of an extra opportunity because you've got a small amount and you're happy to, you know, do the extra work for doing a crowdfunding element of your campaign, then, you know, it's kind of a little bit of icing on the top.
Yeah, I think that's absolutely right. So interestingly, I mean, you've done most of your rounds with, there are two major crowdfunding platforms in the UK, which is Seeders and Crowdcube. Both have been going around the same time, probably both similar sizes. And most of your rounds have been with Seeders. And you did switch platforms for one of your crowdfunding raises. And I've seen many entrepreneurs do that. And I just would love to know more about your rationale for doing that, how you found the experience, and how you make the decision about which platform to raise, so that other people can think about how they might make that decision.
Yeah, I mean, look, at the end of the day, I think both Seeders and Crowdcube are great companies to work with. We had good experiences with both. I think, you know, also having spoken to lots of entrepreneurs who, as you say, have done both, I think what anyone would say is you need to go in with your eyes open, and you need to understand that crowdfunding platforms are not a miracle that just like money starts coming in. You will do all the work, and the success of it will depend on how you run your campaign, not based on the platform. And so in many ways, it doesn't really matter which platform you choose, because the work you need to do is going to be relatively the same. So often it will come down to fees and these types of things, what you can negotiate, and you know how much value they also see in you, as to whether they're willing to negotiate anything special. And I think the other thing is also to keep in mind, you know, when you go and do it, you know, are you reaching a new audience? And so the reason we tried Crowdcube, for example, for one of the rounds is we wanted to just try and reach a new audience and see whether, you know, that would add some additional PR value compared to just going back to a similar audience again. Again, not sure whether we could quantify whether we achieved that or not. But, you know, overall, we had a pretty good experience with both, of course, with the caveats that, you know, it's going to be most of the heavy lifting that you do yourself.
That's true. It's no panacea, is it? So let's move on and talk about coronavirus and the impact that's been having, because for a business like yours, I imagine that's been huge. So I'm really interested to know kind of what it's meant for you. And then also, let's talk about the Future Fund. Yeah. And what your thoughts on that whole offering from the government.
Yeah, I mean, look, at the beginning of this year, we were looking ahead to 2020. And to be honest, it was a really exciting year ahead. I mean, our growth prospects and some of the deals that we're working on and things like that were just about that next level of scale. And then, of course, March happened and Corona happened, and everything very, very quickly changed. Obviously, in a market that depends heavily on travel and tourism, you know, we've been one of the heaviest hit markets. And so, you know, there's no hiding from that. I think everyone in our sector is seeing 90%+ decrease over the past couple of months in terms of revenues coming in. And I think, you know, there will be a number of businesses that don't survive. Actually, we were in a good position because we just closed a round at the beginning of the year. And so we actually weren't planning to raise again for quite some time. And it was interesting because on the one hand, we didn't need the money immediately. And when we made the decision to go and do the Future Fund round, we just thought, you know, look, this is going to be a battle of survival of the fittest. You know, whoever's able to survive longest is going to be in the best position. And our market isn't going to disappear. It's just going to take a little while to recover. And so we saw a huge amount of opportunities in terms of consolidation, potential competitors not being able to make it through this crisis, and all these sorts of other things. And so we said, well, look, actually, let's go out and raise a little bit of a top up now so that we, you know, knowing that in the next 6 to 12 months, the investment climate could be really not easy. And given that the Future Fund was a very specific instrument that actually was quite interesting to investors. And so we went out just to raise a little bit and actually ended up raising more than we expected. Because to be honest, you know, even my board was saying, look, in this investment climate, if you raise 125, you're already doing brilliantly, and then you get the matching from the government. And in total, including the government match funding, we've hit 300. Which is great. And, you know, as I say, more than we expected to do. But what that does is it just means that in 6 months or 12 months, we're unlikely to need to go out to market again. And my prediction is that the economic impact of this crisis is going to mean that raising investment for early stage companies is going to be far more difficult in the next 6 to 12 months. So it's more of a protection and kind of long-term thinking raise as opposed to a cash flow raise. But I also think that's why we were able to raise the investment, because people knew we weren't raising it because of emergency. We were raising it because of strategic long-term thinking, and also the ability to capitalize on an opportunity if it comes along over the next 3 months or 6 months in a market that will likely see some consolidation.
Very smart. Take the money when you can. And so just for listeners, so that they are clear about Future Fund, I mean, it definitely is much more focused on those businesses that are a bit further along, probably not for first round funding, and those businesses that perhaps have taken funding before, because you do have to go out and raise the investment from, you know, professional investors first before the government will give you the money. And is a minimum round of 250, is it?
Yeah, so there's a minimum of raising 125 yourself and raising then the match funding from the Future Fund. I mean, there's a few different rules around it. I think, you know, you're absolutely right. If you haven't raised £250,000 of investment previously, you're actually not eligible. So you have to have demonstrated that you were able to raise capital in a normal world previously in order to qualify for Future Fund. Mm-hmm. So obviously that's one consideration. And of course, Future Fund isn't the only option from government. I mean, there are bounce back loans. I mean, there's CBILS for, you know, companies that have profits and can show that over a sustained period of time. So there's different things out there.
Not for most startups, I'm afraid.
No. And I think, you know, bounce back is the one that obviously is much more accessible. And I think Future Fund, if you meet the criteria, I think it's a really good instrument. But obviously, you know, with that, there are other considerations, like the fact that you essentially are committing to doing another equity round within the next 3 years. So if you just want some funding for now and you don't plan to raise a bigger round, it's also maybe not very suitable. So, you know, it, like everything, it's evaluating the pros and cons of it and understanding whether it's a good fit for what you strategically want to achieve.
Mm. And so it's discounted on the next round, 20% discount, is that right?
Yeah, 20 or more. So, you know, we chose to do 25%, but we didn't put a valuation cap. A lot of companies are putting valuation caps, which essentially limits how much the value of your business can grow by the time you do the next round. Whereas we thought, well, actually, we'd rather give a slightly bigger discount, but then have the freedom, if the company has grown as we plan it to, that we aren't limited by how much the valuation would be if we raise in, you know, 2.5 years' time.
Mm. I mean, let's talk about valuation for a minute, actually, because it's an interesting question, I think. I mean, your valuation's pretty much doubled since you did your first raise. I think you, from a pre-money valuation of 3.3 million, the last round was 6.5 million, which is great progression. Do you think, given the current climate, that your valuation will stay flat for a while?
I mean, I think so. What you see is even large companies like Airbnb, actually, they've done a valuation which is lower than what they've done previously. And so I think there is a risk that some companies will even have to do down rounds. Our view is that by having raised this bit now as a convertible loan and then looking to push out the timeline that we do equity, that by the time we do that equity raise, we aren't going to be looking at a down round. Mm. Equally, we aren't expecting to double or triple the valuation in the next year or two, because I just don't think that the markets are going to bear that. Mm. And so I think that's where, again, you know, when you're in it for the long term, as we are, I think that's okay, because, you know, you will have valuation jumps and, you know, where it levels off at different periods of time. And as long as the direction of travel is consistently in the right direction, I think that's solid. Obviously, investors look for things like the fact that you've never had a down round, and we never have. And I think that's where the consistent growth and then raising, et cetera, has meant that we've got a strong trajectory, and investors can look at that, and that gives them confidence also for the future. So yeah, I mean, ultimately, I think it is going to be a tough sort of 12 to 24 months ahead for almost everyone, you know, unless you're in the healthcare sector and, you know, med tech or something. I think, to be honest, you know, most businesses are going to see that valuations aren't jumping in the way that they have been the past few years.
Mm, yeah, but maybe no bad thing. There's been some pretty crazy valuations, you know, so maybe no bad thing. I mean, before we sort of close off, I'm just interested to know whether, in all your experience of raising investment, you know, what your experience has been like as a female founder, whether you've ever felt any conscious or unconscious bias, or whether that's something you haven't experienced as you've raised.
I mean, look, it's a tricky question, because I'm very much a believer in, you want to find the right people for you. And, you know, to be honest, if people don't want to invest in a female founded business, then they really shouldn't invest in my business. Because, you know, that is part of who we are as a business. And that's who I am. Now, I'm not going to lie. Actually, there have been times where I have felt that there was both conscious and unconscious bias. But at the end of the day, you've got two choices. You can either, you know, call discrimination, get offended, you know, and play victim, or you just say, I want to find the investors who do believe in this and who do believe in me. And they're out there, and they're men, they're women, they're institutions, they come in all shapes and sizes. So, you know, all I say is that we're only going to change the stats if we actually go out and do the raises. Because, you know, I've heard everything from 3% to 10% of money goes into female founded companies. And I think when it's a sole female founder, you're talking less than 3%. So that doesn't look good in terms of odds. But I can say I've done it. I think my investors are incredible. You know, both the men and the women who've invested. And it's just about finding those people who believe in you and who believe in what you're doing. Mm. Is it harder as a woman? Maybe. But at the end of the day, if you've got a great business, I think there are definitely people out there who want to invest and who believe in women doing a great job.
Well, it's absolutely wonderful to see you breaking the odds and as a real shining example to everyone out there. I think, you know, female founders, people who are in the kind of travel and hospitality industry who are feeling a little bit of gloom and doom right now. I think you're proving that it can be done if you've got a great business in the long term. So amazing. So what is next for Under the Doormat? I mean, is that a challenging question given everything that's going on now?
Actually, not at all. I mean, I think for us over the past year, in addition to the fully managed service that we've always done from the beginning, we've also launched Hospiria, which is our business to business arm. Because what we've recognized is there are more than 20,000 small property management companies across Europe and the world. And a lot of them are individual entrepreneurs or family-owned businesses that have been around forever. But they don't know how in this new world, which is dominated by the OTAs, the Airbnbs and Expedias and everything, how to compete and how to, you know, how to win customers. But also, you know, all the technology that it takes to run those businesses efficiently, you know, learning about that and implementing that. I mean, if you're a small property manager in Devon, you probably don't even have people you can hire in the local area who have those skills. And so what we're able to do is take everything that we built for Under the Doormat and package that up and actually offer that to other small property management companies. So they don't have to go through that same growth journey that we've just been through. They can actually just come on board, access all of it straight away, and they can focus on what they're good at, which is providing a great guest experience, having good relationships with their owners, and growing their business. And staying independent and not having to sell out to the Sykes of this world because they feel like they can't compete. And I think just like the hotel industry went through a period where, you know, everyone's had to sign up to the hotel brands like Marriott or Hyatt, you now see a resurgence of independent hotel brands. But they're doing that under the umbrella of things like preferred hotels and resorts and other things. And they need access to that technology and the economies of scale. Even if they're going to remain independent. And that's exactly what we're trying to do in our industry.
Yeah, that's a wonderful ethos. So a solution in a box to help keep the independence going. And I imagine a huge opportunity in front of you there. Exciting.
Oh, very exciting.
Well, congratulations on your latest raise. It's great to see someone getting Future Fund money. And hopefully there'll be more to come. Wish you all the best and thanks for sharing your story today, Merrily.
Oh, thanks so much for having me.
Thanks for following Fundraising Stories with Female Founders. This content is all provided to you for free, so if you've enjoyed today's episode, please subscribe so you never miss another one. Enter the Arena has helped hundreds of female founders fly through pre-raise and investment and onto the exponential growth of their business. Our first-hand experience, expert guidance, and proven programs help female founders unleash the Wonder Woman inside. To see if we can help you do the same, head over to www.enterthearena.co.uk. I'm Julia Elliott-Brown, and I look forward to talking with you soon.